You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations in the Americas, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on Free Speech TV's Dish Network and DirecTV and several hundred cable systems nationwide. Welcome to our program. Mike Papantonio of Ring of Fire fame is in the studio with us today. And Pap, great to have you.
Good to be here.
Great to, I am, you know, you're an attorney. I'm really curious about two things. First is, I think that I saw Mitt Romney commit a federal felony on national television the other night. He walked up to this young kid and said, "If I get elected, I'll give you a job." Isn't it a crime to offer any kind of compensation or any favor to somebody? Or
that's going to be the question at some point. If this continues, a court is going to have to answer. Look, that wasn't isolated. We all know the story. There's an all-out effort for Republican employers to intimidate employees, but they're missing something, Tom. Here's what I think a lot of people miss about this story. It's not important that you get to a criminal threshold. You don't have to. Look, we just hit Walmart. A consortium of lawyers that worked with me hit Walmart for somewhere in the neighborhood of $120 million before it's all paid out for things like that. What they're doing,
coercion.
What an employer is doing to an employee when he says, "If you don't vote a certain way, then you're going to lose your job." That's the coercion part. But what they're doing is extracting a value out of the employee.
Right.
Think about it. It's a value to say, go out, go vote, vote this way. There's almost an analysis that I think of. I think of the employer, like a Walmart, for example, who might tell an employee, "You're off the clock now. I want you to go out and sign out off of the clock. But by the way, I need 200 boxes in the back moved after you're off the clock."
Well, that's what Walmart was doing.
That's exactly
when
what they were doing.
Them.
That's exactly what they were doing. So I think of that. I think of an employer who sexually enslaves an employee, not overtly. Maybe they don't. Sexual harassment cases. Most of those are not. They're not overt. You know, they're not do this or. They're the implicit. They're the suggestion.
Right.
And I look at, if I'm an employer and I know that you have guys like me and some of the best lawyers in this country that are already looking, what does the lawsuit look like?
Mm-hmm.
When you bring a lawsuit and you say, for example, to the coal miners, the story up in the Murray Energy in Ohio,
right,
where the coal miners were told, "Look, if you don't give to this PAC, you might not have a job."
Right. Or please show up for this photo op.
That's right.
They didn't even have to say, "If you don't show up, you will be fired."
That's right. So juries don't look, everybody in some capacity has worked in their lives. Everybody has experienced that idea of being under the man's thumb,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
But when you put them on a jury and you say, this is what they did, they told this employee that if you don't vote Republican, if you don't vote Mitt Romney, you might not be able to feed your children next month. Because we might take your job. You may not be able to pay for health care because we might take your job. How much more draconian can you get? So I got to tell you, the people I'm talking about that I've tried cases with that are very similar to this, a company needs to pay attention before they just say, "I'm going to go do that."
Yeah. Now, but what this is getting to is this beyond, you know, my semi joke about, did Mitt Romney commit a federal felony by telling this kid he'd give him a job? Is Mitt Romney back in June talking to the National Association of Independent Businesses, I guess it was, NFIB, National Federation of Independent Businesses,
right,
and saying, well, here's the actual clip. This is Mitt Romney.
I hope you make it very clear to your employees what you believe is in the best interest of your enterprise and therefore their job and their future in the upcoming elections. And whether you agree with me or you agree with President Obama or whatever your political view, I hope you pass those along to your employees.
Right. And then he goes on to say, oh, and by the way, while it used to be a crime for you to do that under Actually, U.S. Code 441B, which says about corporations or political funds, quote, it shall be unlawful to make a contribution or expenditure by utilizing money or anything of value secured by physical force, job discrimination, financial reprisals, or the threat of forced job discrimination or financial reprisals to influence voters. That's also section 101 of the 1101 of the labor code makes it a crime for CEOs to engage in actions, quote, controlling or directing or tending to control or direct the political activities or affiliations of employees, end quote. Additionally, labor law section 1102 says, quote, employers may not coerce employees to adopt a particular course of political action. And then back to Title II, Chapter 14, Subchapter 1, the law that I was reading earlier, this is a piece that Shano tracked down and highlighted. Anything of value secured by physical force, I guess that's the one I just read to you. Yeah, so this is what Citizens United knocked down.
They might have knocked it down. Now
Romney's
now,
asserting
now,
this.
Listen, when Romney says, this is my opinion of the law.
Well, here, in fact, let's listen to how Romney said it. Here he is.
Nothing illegal about you talking to your employees about what you believe is best for the business.
Yeah. Listen, when I'm taking legal advice from somebody who stores their money offshore, or legal advice from somebody who hustles a blind trust in a way that is completely illegal, I'm suspect from the beginning. But Tom, let me answer it this way, okay? In every major lawsuit that takes place in the country, the attorney bringing the case has some options. One of those options is that they can allege what they call the common law violation of the law. They can use statutory language and they can say, listen, we're not suggesting that the criminal code has been violated, but let me show you what the standard is for the criminal code. Not only have we arrived at a standard more significant than that, but we've proven here by a preponderance of the evidence that everything that this individual did falls within the realm of the statute.
But here's the bottom line. What the Romney campaign is betting is whether this is illegal or not. And this is the same thing Karl Rove is betting. I mean, there's a very, very good probability that he's going to lose in the courts by saying that his social welfare nonprofit organization can hide his donors, right? There's a very good chance he's going to lose that. But it'll be after the election.
Right.
And if he's president, I mean, it's like, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush won the election. It ended the investigations into the Iran-Contra and, you know, whether or not Bush the Reagan administration and Bill Casey had a secret deal with the Ayatollahs to keep the hostages and everything else.
Right. Well, the only reason I raised this is I'm not talking about election issues here. I'm talking about a lawyer who has 30 employees come to him and say, this is what happened to me. Do you want to bring a case? Employers doing this need to be very, very careful. That would be my advice.
Yeah, but apparently they're doing it, and the Koch brothers sent out a letter to, 50,000 people, was the this is pretty amazing. So curious your thoughts on this, and we will be getting to your calls in just a few minutes on these topics. And also, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the news today. I think, though, that this is one of the big ones. This is one of the big basic ones. There is where to go here? Here we go. Corporations not paying their fair share in taxes. You know, the Republicans are screaming about the deficit and the debt and all this kind of thing. If the corporations that are hiding their money offshore simply paid U.S. taxes on that money as if they'd made that money here, which they should be doing, used to be they used to have to, it would cut the budget deficit in half. In half. The other half, of course, is caused by the Bush tax cuts. So we could get rid of that, too. Anyhow, there's a lot in the news, a lot going on. Mike Papatonio and I are going to be talking here over the next couple of hours about a whole variety of things. Peter Ferrara is going to drop by. We're going to see how long it takes for him to start sputtering. Excuse me. Peter is always a wonderful debate partner. And we'll be taking your calls, too, right after the break. 15 minutes past the hour, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Also, you can check out our new free app, both for the iPhone and the iPad, optimized for the new special Retina display over at the iPad store.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it
burned.
Oh,
of course! Ring of Fire Radio! Of course! It took me a moment. Welcome back. Tom Hartman and Mike Papantonio here in the studio hanging out with us in Washington, D.C. today in a beautiful, hot day it is. Actually, it's not so hot outside. It's just that our building has turned off their air conditioning, so we're finding out how warm it can get with all these lights on. Tag Romney, I find this absolutely fascinating, Pap. Tag Romney, who decided after 9/11 that he wasn't going to volunteer to serve his country. In fact, Mitt has famously said that his five sons are serving their country by working on his campaign. Tag Romney, who Daddy Mitt gave $10 million to start his own hedge fund. And it's not even a pirate equity company. It's not even a normal pirate equity company. Instead, what he does is he goes to other private equity companies and says, give me a share of your business. You know, give me a little slice of your business, and I'll kind of aggregate it for my investors. So it's almost like the banksters, you know, tranching loans and then selling CDOs on them. I mean, it's bizarre, this business model. Nobody else could pull it off because nobody else has the connections. They can't go to the other private equity firms and say, my dad's Mitt Romney. And now this guy says he wants to, quote, take a swing at Obama. He's a tough guy now, right?
Well, the sons are coming in the news in a lot of ways, Tom. First of all, there's the story about the blind trust. You remember Romney was on the circuit telling us, well, he doesn't have any control over his money because the blind trust controls his money. Then we find out his personal lawyer is the guy in charge of the blind trust.
Yep.
Then we find out that one of the boys took $10 million from the trust and put it into his company.
Right, that would be Tag.
It doesn't sound blind to me. And Tag gets into the news that way. That's the first time we start really understanding. Then we start learning that they don't really want Tag in company out front all that much, because Tag in company, the rest of the boys and Mrs. Romney aren't always saying the kind of things that have a lot of appeal to the American public. But I think, what I thought of when I heard Tag make that statement, it is that the nut doesn't fall far from the tree. Understand that this is a guy, this is a presidential candidate, wanted to invade Iran, wanted to invade North Korea, wanted to invade Syria before he had any answers of the problems that could have been handled diplomatically. I've said this so many times, and I really believe this time, we focus too much on the economy. About with Mitt Romney. When I see Mitt Romney, I see mushroom clouds behind his head.
Well, and war is an economic issue. You've got $2 trillion worth of debt right now sitting here in the United States as a consequence of George Bush starting two wars, putting them on the national credit card.
Yeah. So Tag doesn't surprise me at all, because that's Daddy. Swing first, drop the bombs first, get us involved in war first, and then start asking questions.
Yeah. Bill DeMay says, I'm going to ask you what I think a lot of people want to know. What would you like to hear the President of the United States? What is it like for you to hear the President of the United States call your dad a liar? How do you react to that? And he says, jump out of your seat. You want to rush down to the debate stage and take a swing at him. But, you can't do that because there's Secret Service between you and him. So apparently he's restrained by visible police presence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is the same thing as Romney. He doesn't realize he's restrained by the fact that if he would have gone and invaded Iran when he wanted to and he had the power to do it, he would have been restrained by both China and Russia.
Yeah.
And that's a problem for soccer mom who thinks that the economy is more important than world affairs.
Right, and if you think that the Sunni-Shia split is going to keep the Muslim world split, forget it. So far we've only bombed Sunni countries, and now we start bombing Shia, Shia Iran.
The whole world gets involved.
Man, Islam, you're going to see people all, regardless of their sect, shall we say, or denomination, as it may be. Dan, listening to the program in Cornelius, North Carolina. Hey, Dan, you're on the air with Tom and Pat.
Hey, guys. How are you this afternoon?
Great. What's up?
Just a couple of thoughts. First of all, thanks, Tom. I really enjoy your show. I find it to be the most informative show on the air today, and I learn a great deal from it each day.
Thank you.
My profession is as a traveling salesman. And I had the opportunity. I noticed I was going to be passing very near Freeport, Illinois the other day. And so I jumped off the highway, and I headed about an hour over to visit with the the good folks at Sensata.
Hmm.
My heart goes out to those folks.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go over and just spend some time with them. And, you know, the one thing that dawned on me while I was there, Tom, was it wasn't just Democrats standing under the tent that is now known as Bainport,
right.
But there were Republicans alike, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I left, I had this thought, you know, I says, you know, when it comes to these poor folks out there and their families, the one thing that that they had in common was they were bipartisan, you know, in their insignificance. You know, and that was really a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one point I wanted to make. The other one was, you know, I'm glad you brought up about the blind trust, and I'm just curious, what kind of person would hide behind a blind trust, and how does that ease that person's conscience? I hope that the president takes the opportunity in the next 20 days to bring him to task on that. And one last thing is, I think Tag better remember that he drew first blood.
Yeah, there you go. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Pap, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that the problem that you have when you have family or surrogates saying things and doing things is you never know where it's going to go. The media right now, especially 2 weeks out from an election, is like it's like a shark. They're hunting. They're, you know, they're looking for something. So something is a night. I mean, you can see it. He was upset. He didn't like his dad being mishandled. But you can't. You have to restrain yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, what if Michelle Obama's brother had said, "I'm going to go do that to Mitt"?
Oh my God! I mean, you know, Barack Obama just uses the word "damn" in a press conference, and the screaming headline over a very dark picture of President Obama is "Obama goes street."
Exactly.
Right? I mean, can you imagine? That's one of the questions that you have to ask yourself is, how would Fox handle it if a Democrat had done it? If Barack Obama had walked up to somebody and said, "If I'm elected, I'm going to hire you," they would be calling for his impeachment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, Fox News wouldn't just be calling for his impeachment. They'd be calling for him to be hauled off in chains, and Daryl Issa would be holding hearings. More, your calls, our thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. Brad in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Brad, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, you're not going to believe this, but I was in the queue yesterday and your program ended, so I thought, oh, well, I gave it a shot.
Uh-huh.
And I was driving up from Vancouver to Seattle. Now I'm in Amsterdam. I'm listening to one of the three English stations, and there's your ad for the big picture. And I thought, okay, I got to call back.
Oh, that's great. So you're in Amsterdam. You're in Amsterdam, Holland.
Well, right now it's 9:35 in the evening. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I'm quickly running out of gas here. But
okay.
The point is, I was going to make yesterday is, I understand and I respect that you said you can't really Monday morning quarterback Obama in a debate, but I really feel that when Romney admitted that his party has concentrated too much on big business in his past, Obama should have gone for the jugular.
When did he admit that?
They still are.
How did I miss
that?
When did he admit that? What did he say? I must have missed
that. Oh, absolutely.
That.
Yeah, he said, I'm probably going to blow the quote here, so I'm going to paraphrase. My party has concentrated on big business far too much in the past. I'm going to concentrate on small businesses to grow this economy.
Yeah, I remember something like that. I remember thinking the Koch brothers have a small business.
Obama should have gone right for the throat. You know, of course your party has gone for big business. They always have and they always will and they still are.
Yeah.
And I'm just so frustrated that he didn't. But, you know, like you said, you can't Monday morning quarterback this thing because you look back on things you've done going, I should have said that. But
sure.
I feel that. But anyways, this whole thing, you know, blew right back up when I saw your ad, your video, you know, on one of the three English channels in Amsterdam going, I've got to call in.
Yeah, that's the RT channel there in Holland. I think that's
exactly,
great.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Brad, thank you very much for the call. And great to hear from you.
I appreciate your efforts, and I haven't listened to you a lot, but on my three-hour commute to Seattle, I do, and you're brilliant. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Brad. Thanks for your kind words. And Yeah, that's President Obama has made it very, very clear that he's about the middle class. I mean, the Democratic Party has made it very clear, you know, for a long, long time. I mean, arguably since Franklin Roosevelt, in a very overt fashion, that they're about the middle class. There were some progressives back before then, like Teddy Roosevelt, but he was such an outlier that the Republican Party threw him out of the party. Basically, since the 1870s, when the big railroad corporations seized control of the Republicans. And back then, you look at the histories of that era of the 1860s, the 1870s, early 1880s, and the Republicans who were the anti-slavery Republicans are referred to as the radical Republicans. And the Republicans who were basically just in favor of, you know, taking the money from the railroads and literally buying elections and doing whatever they were paid to do, they're referred to as the Republicans. And that's the modern-day Republican Party. Pat?
Yeah, well, you're going to see a rebuild of the Republican Party. If they do lose this election, it's going to be dramatic. I mean, it's going to be a dramatic rebuild. And part of what
you think they're going to kick out the Tea Party?
Well, I think they have to. I think they have to rebuild the party. I don't know if you followed this movement. They launched themselves about maybe a year and a half ago, the no labels idea.
Right.
Well, the no labels idea, people don't understand, it's merely an extension of the Republican Party.
Sure.
You see, it was driven by Joe Scarborough and Mark McKinnon and some of these folks that have been hugely Republican for so long. Bloomberg was part of it. And the reason they came up with no labels and they say don't label us according to our acts is because their acts are so ugly. Their associations are so ugly. So they're saying, we're different now. We're new, improved. We're the new tide.
Right.
So what we're going to see after this election is the new, improved, no labels. We're the new tide. We're not the old, you know, we're not granddaddy's Republican Party anymore. We care about small business. We care about women. Minorities matter. They have to go there because otherwise they're the Whig Party. You know the history of the Whig Party.
Oh, yeah, the Whigs imploded in the 1830s.
Same kind of reason.
You know, yeah, and were replaced ultimately by the Republicans.
Exactly. Yeah. And so no labels is the precursor for that. Yeah. I used to really laugh when I'd see these no labels guys. You know, don't label us. Well, nobody wants to be labeled as a Republican. A thinking person doesn't want to have that kind of ink about them. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they want to relabel. They want to rebrand.
Yeah, and they're going to have to. They got some serious problems. Gary in East Point, Michigan. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
Mike, you guys are two of the best. Mike, thanks. I wish I could get you more. I hear, listen to you every time you suffer Tom and Ed. But my question, Tom, is during the debate.
Hey, let me just toss in here.
Yeah.
Pap does a show, a weekend show, Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. You can find the stations
right.
that it's on, and if it's not on your local station, give him a call and give him a poke.
Okay, I will.
Okay.
You're great, Mike. I love when you take these people on. Tom, something went under the radar to me in the debate, and I would, you know, like you to riff on it, you and Mike. But it was about immigration, and Romney said, we love immigrants, something to the effect that we love immigrants. As a matter of fact, if you have a degree in engineering, a degree in something else, stapled it to your passport and come on over here.
Yeah. Are you a nurse? Come on over. You know, from the Philippines? Sure, yeah, replace my daughter's job.
And Obama let it go, and I thought, boy, here's the time. What about American workers, Obama? Come on, get them. And it was just, and I haven't heard much said about it since. So yeah. I'd like you two guys to riff on that. And
yeah. Okay, you got it. You got it.
I haven't heard much about it.
Thank you very much for the call. And let me add to that, and you probably know more about, as an attorney, maybe you know more about immigration law than I do. My experience has always been as an employer. We, back in the 80s, Louise and I owned an ad agency in Atlanta, and we had a client. We were doing an in-house publication for them, and it was a multinational corporation, and they needed their newsletter done in English, Japanese, and Spanish. And so we ran an ad in the Atlanta Constitution Journal saying we were looking for a typesetter who could proofread copy in English, Spanish, and Japanese, figuring, you know, I'm going to end up having to hire three people, but what the hell? Let's try it. It's $35 for an ad. And this guy, Shinji, his first name, I don't want to put his last name out, responded to the ad. And he was born in Japan. His parents moved to Peru when he was around 12, 13 years old. His father worked for a Japanese company in Peru until he was 18 or 19. He came to the United States. He got his college degree and his master's degree in fine arts in the United States. He had just graduated from college. He had all the advertising typesetting background, and he spoke fluently three languages and could typeset in them. But he didn't have a work permit. So we went to the INS. I went to the INS and said, I would like to get a work permit for this guy because he's the only guy I can find. And it took me like 3 months of proving that I wasn't trying. I was not going to pay him less than anybody else. It was a major hassle to hire this guy. How things have changed. I mean, this was early on in the Reagan administration. Things have changed so much now that these companies, they're just bringing people in on these visas. They don't have to prove that there's no American.
If they're a scientist, if they're a doctor, if they are.
Right, right.
But not the average worker, the average person that needs a job and actually adds tremendous amounts to this economy. That person.
No. And the other thing I wanted you to address is this Sensata company. Apparently, Bain brought the Chinese people who are going to run the machines over to learn how to run the machines on some kind of a work permit, on some kind of a visa. If they were here on a tourist visa, it was a violation of it. And if they were here on a work visa, I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, it is, you know, Romney can't help himself. I mean, when you've come up in a world to where you can, it was apparent to anybody paying attention, that statement that was just mentioned. It's interesting that was raised. I caught it.
Yeah.
And because it's this arrogance of affluence. Mm. And it is, bring in your scientists, bring in your PhDs, bring in the doctors and the overachievers. But, you know, we're going to ship the jobs overseas. You see, we're going to ship all the workers' jobs overseas, so it doesn't make any difference if you bring in workers. That, you know, there was a lot bundled up in that statement by Romney.
Yeah.
And my reaction to that was, here's another softball, Mr. President. Here it is.
Yeah.
Take your shot. I didn't hear the shot.
Yeah.
But at any rate, the nuances to what Romney says, I've really concluded he can't help himself. He's been raised like that. It's part of his fabric.
What happened to the concept? I mean, both of us have known a lot of very affluent people in our lives. You can't get to be our age and certainly be in the world of business. What happened to the concept of noblesse oblige? Franklin Roosevelt came from a very wealthy family, and he felt that it was his obligation to help lift people up. Jack Kennedy came from a wealthy family. So did Bobby. So did Teddy. So did his older brother Joe, went off and died in World War II. I mean, these guys, this wasn't campaign hype. They genuinely believed it. I don't see an iota of that coming out of Romney. That sense that because he has been so blessed, he has an obligation to help others.
Yeah, there used to be a real division. I mean, it's an interesting notion about that. It's called the Southern plantation aristocracy, and maybe we can talk about it when you have a little more time.
We can do it coming back to the break.
But I think it's a pretty important way to understand what's happened with that concept and what's happened with the new aristocracy who feels no kinship with anybody out of that million-dollar club.
Yeah, it's like the I got mine bubble.
Yeah.
The direction that I see this country, last time I was in Bogota, Colombia, driving down the street, there was a big billboard for a new neighborhood, new community, buy a home. Mm-hmm. And there's a family, a mom and a little kid playing in the backyard. And in the foreground of the picture is the chain link fence with electrified barbed wire and the guy standing there with the AK-47 in front of it. I mean, that's
the division.
Yeah, right. I mean, you're either really poor or you got a guy with an AK-47. I mean, that's the direction Romney wants to take this country. I'm not for it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The Southern plantation mentality. More on that in 5 minutes. Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
Ah! Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Okay, Pap, you were going to tell a story of the Southern plantation, aristocracy.
Yeah.
But the question, let me set it up for anybody who just tuned in. What happened to the idea of noblesse oblige in the United States? Before the Reagan administration, many of the wealthy in America either genuinely believed or at least felt the obligation to behave as if they believed that because of their wealth, they had an obligation to help others, whether it was the Kennedy family and the Roosevelt family actually serving America, or whether it was the Rockefeller and the Carnegies and the Mellons endowing libraries and museums and things. There was this sense of, we're the nobility, we have an obligation to serve, the noblesse oblige. I see none of that in Mitt Romney. I see none of that. Basically, since Reagan said, you know, we're not going to do like Jimmy Carter did and have a people's, you know, ball. We're going to charge a fortune to get into the, you know, to dance with the, you know, with the president. And we're going to, you know, it's like everything changed in the 80s and it hasn't changed back. So you were saying there's an answer to this.
Well, there is. It's not my idea. Sarah Robinson is a great writer for Alternet, and some mm-hmm. really very talented Southern writers have spent time thinking about this and writing about it. And it shows you the dichotomy between what we used to call the Northern aristocracy. The Northern aristocracy came from a fabric of Puritan. It was the Puritan Northern aristocracy. Now they made a lot of money. They built big houses for themselves. But at the same time, the community was part of the fabric, you see.
Sure.
The Northern aristocracy built libraries. They built schools. They took care of the commons. They took care of America's underclass. They felt like it was their social responsibility to do that. Now, if you take that and compare to what most Southern writers, how they characterize the Southern aristocracy, it's completely different. The Southern aristocracy, to some degree, felt like they were entitled to certain things. God had blessed them. The reason they're part of the aristocracy is because they have lived right. They've been given the big house.
Calvinism,
entirely Calvinism. Exactly. And rather than having a sense of community, rather than having a sense that we have to build the library as a common good, it is that they wanted to extract as much as they could from the lesser people, the less than plantation owners.
And it started with slavery. That's the greatest example of it.
Perfect example, but it went beyond slavery, Tom. Today it goes beyond slavery. Today there is that notion of the Southern aristocracy they are where they are because they were some God-given event that put them there. And because of that, they can pollute the rivers. It's their right to do that. They can pollute the air. They can extract as much as they want. Now, I'd love to say that's my original thought, but there are many, many writers that have analyzed this. And here's what they say. They say that concept of Southern aristocracy now pervades American politics completely. It's been bought up out of Texas in Mississippi. It's been bought up. It's now part of the Republican notion of aristocracy.
I wonder if that's what Dwight Eisenhower was talking about in his letter to Edgar in 1954, his brother, where he said, should any political party advocate the end of Social Security, labor laws, or farm legislation, that party will never be seen again. I realize there are a few down in Texas, a few oil millionaires in Texas, for the Hunt brothers and others, you know who I mean,
yes,
who believe that it is possible to do this, but their number is small and they are stupid.
Mm-hmm.
verbatim.
Exactly.
I mean, from Dwight Eisenhower, president of the United States.
But now
but he
norm.
Was talking about the South.
Yeah, he was talking about the South. And so this issue, I think, is a very real issue. It's not a regional issue. Now these very same people who used to think like that control all parts of the aristocracy, the money people.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Steve in Glenville, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Long time listener, first time caller. It's
in
Glenview.
Steve, your phone is breaking up.
Why did the Democrats drop?
I'm sorry, Steve. Your phone is breaking up so badly. I'm going to please try again, maybe with a different phone. And hopefully it's your phone and not ours. Linda in Laurinburg, North Carolina. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mike. It's good seeing two great hosts at the same time.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I was wondering, what do you think is the possibility of electors in the Electoral College being bought off, especially in the close races?
I think the probabilities are close to zero. There's been a total of 18 or 19 electors since the beginning of the Republic who changed their votes, and in most cases they did it as matters of conscience around issues like slavery. I think it's only happened two or three times in the last 50 or 100 years, and it's very, very rare. So I'm not so concerned. Linda, thank you for the call. I'm not so concerned about that. I'm concerned about this story I'm seeing right here in the news today about how a sheriff, a Republican sheriff, an elected Republican sheriff in Virginia, found a bunch of voter registrations in the wastebasket. And he's looking into, what's going on. Are the Republicans still up to these games where if you say, yes, I'm a Democrat, your voter registration goes in the trash? Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, somebody called in about Greg Palast earlier is talking about the 80,000. Well, the point is this: it's part of the plan. I mean, we can't ignore it. It's not conspiracy. It's not tinfoil hat talk to say the Republicans have set up. We heard them admit that they've set up to try to keep Democrats from voting. They've said it.
We got the Pennsylvania clip.
Pennsylvania clip. It was in one form or fashion. It's been said many times. So it's a reality.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, they're just pretty, not just unambiguous about it. They're quite proud of it. I mean, they just go on and on about this. So and in fact, you know, you can't find it. Okay. Oh, you got it. Here it is.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Now, this is on the senior Republicans in Pennsylvania. Just
Jim Greer in Florida.
Yeah.
Jim Greer in Florida said the same thing. The key man in the Republican Party said, we did this to keep minorities from voting. We have these rules in place to keep minorities. Now, he did that while he was being deposed for a criminal case.
Wow.
So he was under oath, raised his right hand, and said, we did this to keep people from voting.
Wow. Wow. And still we have, 17 states now, I think?
Yeah.
Something like that, where these voter ID suppression
still
laws
in
are in place. We'll be back. Peter Farrar is going to drop by. We're going to have an interesting little conversation with him about free speech rights for companies. Should CEOs have free speech rights? Don't they? Did they? Should they?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we have Mitt Romney telling CEOs that they should use their position of power to try to get their employees to do something that they want. Now, if as an employer you say to an employee explicitly or implicitly, how'd you like to do something sexual? I don't want to get too graphic here, but you can get busted pretty badly. We got laws against using that power position over people, at least to get sexual favors from them. But political favors? Seems like the Republicans think that's just a fine idea. It used to be illegal. Citizens United said, no. This is an issue of free speech. Peter Farrar is with us. He's a senior fellow with the Carlson Center for Public Policy, theCCPP.org. Awful close to the old Soviet logo there, isn't it, Peter?
You know, we've raised that point before. There's one letter off.
Yeah.
Communist Party, CCCP. I've raised that before, but to no avail.
Oh, well, okay. It's theCCPP.org. And Peter Farrar, how can you defend employers using their position of power to coerce their employees or frankly, threaten them? I mean, you know, the Koch brothers, Georgia-Pacific, basically, you know, this is not going to be in the best interest of the company and therefore you. How can a worker's interest always be congruent with the interests of the company?
Well, I'm not interested in defending coercion or forcing people to do anything. So, I'm not defending that at all. Now, it's perfectly legitimate for employers to say if he's reelected and he follows the policies, they'll have these consequences for my company. That's perfectly legitimate, and that's all I've seen the Koch brothers do. And so I think you're a little
But the consequence that they're predicting is not one that you can demonstrate with, you know, pure logic or solid reality. It's a matter of political opinion. So this is basically asserting the political opinion.
Yeah, well, people have always been entitled to assert political opinions since the founding of the country. It goes back to the 1776, actually.
Well, I don't disagree with you about free speech, but I'm talking about somebody who runs a kingdom, basically. The workplace is a kingdom. The CEO is essentially a king. And in right to work for less states, they have absolute power. I mean, they can dismiss anybody anytime for any reasons. And what they're saying is, as a king, here's what I have to say. Now, if the workers want to speak back, they can get fired, and they know it. That's an imbalance of power. Shouldn't we protect people in? I mean, we've had laws on the books for years and years that protected workers against their employers shoving their political perspectives down their throats. Citizens United blew that up. I think the Supreme Court called this wrong.
Citizen United doesn't have anything to do with it. There's always business has always been free to say that if these policies are followed, the person supporting these policies is elected, it will have these consequences for our company, we believe. And they've always been free to do that. Citizens United has nothing to do with it.
So, well, I strongly disagree. I mean, I would refer you to U.S. Code 441B, Contributions or Expenditures by National Banks, Corporations, or Labor Organizations is the title. It's Title II, Chapter 14 of the FEC laws. And it says that, you know, anything of value secured by physical force, job discrimination, financial reprisals, or the threat of forced job discrimination or financial reprisal. Now, I would say the threat of losing your job is a threat of financial reprisal. It's illegal.
Well,
at least it used to be.
I'm perfectly fine with
this law is referred to in the Citizens United decision.
I'm perfectly fine with saying to employers, if you threaten to fire your employees unless they vote a certain way or unless they participate in a campaign or election, that's against the law. I'm perfectly fine. So if that already says that in the law, that's also good.
No, well, this is the law that is specifically referenced in Citizens United as we, the five right-wing crazies on the court, are striking this down. I shouldn't say crazies. I don't mean to offend you.
Well, I participated in the Citizens United case. I filed briefs in favor of Citizens United. And I'm also a graduate of Harvard Law School and also a member of the Supreme Court Bar. And so, I'm telling you that, in regard to what these employers are doing today and what, these left-wing websites are saying about what these employers are doing today, that's just communication and there's no coercion involved in that. And so it always has been perfectly legal. And
communication that you may lose your job is not a form of coercion?
I'm not in favor of you may lose your job.
That's in some of these communications.
Well, you know, that issue never came up when I participated in Citizens United. I didn't see you there either. I didn't see you participating at the time, but I was there actually filing briefs actually all the way up and down the scale, district court, circuit court, Supreme Court, in favor of Citizens United. I never saw the argument that, well, employers need to be free to threaten to fire their workers if they don't vote a certain way. I never saw that in the case.
Okay.
Actually.
So, but you are in favor of this weird notion that money is somehow speech? I thought money was property.
I'm just in favor of speech. That's all. All they're doing, and all these accusations that are being made today, all the employers are doing is simple speech. They're just saying, we think that if these policies are followed or Obama's reelected, it'll have these consequences for country. And I agree with them. I've been saying for over a year, I published a small book a year ago, Obama and the Crash of 2013, arguing that if his, what he's already enacted into law for next year, the comprehensive tax rate increase of January 1st go into effect, there will be another.
Oh, wait a minute. Obama didn't put that into law. The Republicans did when they passed the Bush tax cuts by reconciliation. They automatically expire at the end of 10 years.
There was Obamacare that's going into effect January 1st. And
right, that's going to cut $180 billion out of the budget.
And the expiration of the Bush tax cuts that Obama negotiated with the Democrats to extend to next year. He extended it to next year because he recognized at the time that you can't increase taxes in a weak economy.
No, not true. He extended the Bush tax cuts because that was the price to
stupider today than it was back then.
He extended the Bush tax cuts because that was the price to get unemployment insurance extended, because the Republicans were opposed to people getting extended unemployment benefits. In fact, the compromise was that they cut them from 100 weeks down to 78 weeks or 87 weeks or something like that.
That's not what his chief economic policy advisor, Larry Summers, said. He said that he agreed that if they allowed those tax rate increases to go into effect at that time, it would cut short the recovery and lead to another recession.
Peter, you got me there because
we have a worse economy now.
You start quoting Larry Summers, and my head will explode.
Your president appointed him.
Don't remind me about it. So, but in any case, you just think it's just fine. That these employers say to their employees, you know, it's my opinion that you will lose your job or you may lose your job if President Obama gets reelected. But I'm guessing you don't think that it should be a matter of law that if 51% of the employees sign a card saying we'd like there to be a union, that there's a union.
Well, I think there should be a free election among the employees as to whether there should be a union, which is current law. And you don't.
Isn't 51% of people saying yes an election?
You know, the only people who oppose secret ballot elections as to whether there should be a union are the unions and you.
No, I'm not opposing a secret ballot. Well, I'm saying let's make it a lot easier. We're talking about card check here. And the reason I bring this up is because this is where the employees can speak back to the employer about politics. Once 51% sign the card and say, yes, there's a union, then there has to be an election to decide which union is going to represent them, who are going to be the elected representatives of that union, what are going to be the rules and bylaws of that union. There is a series of elections that follow that.
Now, the original card check law says you sign 51%, you don't get the election. And it's like telling them to announce their preferences one by one in the stadium full of MSNBC idiots.
From the get-go, what card check does is it allows you to have an election. Anyhow, Peter Ferrara, you can check out his writing. Senior fellow, Carlson Center for Public Policy, theccpp.org. Peter, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks.
Always fun talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more right after this. Stick around. Welcome back. And one of our callers today, Shano, in his infinite wisdom and caprice, is going to identify that caller as the person who's going to get a free copy, autographed copy, of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, my book that quite literally starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with Citizens United, and what's going on and how it's all going on. And Mike Papantonio, welcome back. Great to have you with us still.
Good to be here, Tom.
Yeah. Any thoughts on any of the points that Peter Ferrara had to make?
Well, I mean, the notion that that money is free speech, I mean, we've been over that before. Money wasn't free speech for a long time because the people who said it wasn't, the court system that said it wasn't free speech, understood that we'd have foreign countries coming into America buying our politics. And sure enough, that's what we have today.
Sure. Shelley Adelson's money's coming from.
Exactly. Now we're following the money and we're getting money. Money's coming in from China, India, all parts of the world to buy our elections. So over in China right now, they're trying to pick who our senators are, or who our president is, and they're sending money over there. So if that's the kind of money that he says is free speech, it's a huge risk to democracy if it is free speech.
It was the Buckley case, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was the turning point.
Exactly.
Buckley versus Vallejo.
Very important case.
And that, of course, followed.
But that was the rationale in the case. If you go back and look, they say we have to control where the money comes from because we'll have foreign countries buying our politics.
Hmm. Interesting. Janet, listening to WCPT in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Hi, Tom and Mike. Listen to you guys all the time.
Thank you.
And I have to tell you how upset I was the other night watching that debate. The arrogance of Mitt Romney to the President of the United States made me weep. Who in the name of God does he think he is talking to the President that way?
Well, let me share a quick opinion with you, if I may. Mitt Romney's mother was told after her third or fourth child was born that she could not have any more children, that she was sterile. And then she became pregnant with Mitt, and from the time he was born, throughout his life, now just imagine that she called him their miracle baby. There's TV interviews where she's talked about this when her husband was running for president. Here's a young man who was told that he was divinely birthed, basically. Not virgin birth, but he was a miracle. He's special. He was put on earth for a special purpose. And then you combine that with the White Horse prophecy out of the Mormon Church. And I bring this up and people who aren't Mormons have no idea what I'm talking about. But every time we've done this, the board gets slammed. Right now there's not any open lines, but the board gets slammed with Mormons calling up going, yeah, I've been hearing about the White Horse prophecy since I was 5 years old. Everybody knows about that. It's not official doctrine of the church, but everybody knows about it. That when the Constitution is hanging by a thread, then a Mormon will step forward, lead the country, and save the nation. And this is the basis. And this is why this is why Joseph Smith ran for president back in the election of 1844, I think it was, or maybe 48. And he was murdered a few months before the election. So, you know, we never saw how that turned out. But the Constitution was hanging by a thread at that time. I mean, this is just before the Civil War. We were having terrible problems in this country. And you could argue that we're having terrible problems right now. And I'd say with the NDAA and things, I could make the case that the Constitution's hanging by a thread. So I think you say, who does Mitt Romney think he is? I personally believe that he personally believes that he's been picked by God to be the man who's going to save America. Now, he has no idea how he's going to do that because he trusts, I believe, that God is going to guide him in every step of the way. Because after all, look at his life. God has obviously guided every step. It's this very Calvinistic perspective that God picks out the good people by blessing them and giving them all these kinds. And I that really concerns me because thank you, Janet, for the call and for bringing this up. There is no more powerful force on earth than belief. Look around you. Look at everything you see around you. Everything you see started as an idea in someone's mind, and not just an idea. Somebody didn't just say, hey, I think, that microphone, or I'll hatch the idea for a microphone, or I'll hatch the idea for a TV camera, or for a table, or for a pen. No. They not only had the idea, but then they believed enough in themselves that they took that idea all the way to the point where it went into the marketplace, and now you're looking at it, whether it's a building or a ballpoint pen. There's no power on earth more powerful than the force of belief. And Mitt Romney, I think, believes that it's his destiny to be president of the United States. And I think he's believed that. His father talked about the White Horse Prophecy when he was running for president. And I think he bestowed that on his son. And that really concerns me, because when you believe something like that, that powerfully, that gives you license to do things like lie, cheat, and steal for the greater good. The old notion of the white lie. There's actually a Catholic doctrine associated with this that Protestants sometimes refer to. I forget the name of it. It's a Latin name. Do you know what it is?
Mormon also, that it's okay to lie in furtherance of the church or the family.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So that's an excusable lie. I don't know if that's what the Mormons call it, but that's the notion of it, the excusable lie. Right. I lie to further something much better.
Yeah, so this isn't like I'm not sitting here trying to slam the Mormons, you know, and going off on magic underwear and you get your own planet stuff. This is just, he could have been born into any religion, but I really think he thinks this is his destiny. And that scares the hell out of me. I'm curious if you think I got a tinfoil hat on here.
No, you don't. Tom, one of the issues that has not been talked about enough in this election, and it's almost as if the media is so terrified to talk about what is this thing called Mormonism and how might it affect the decisions that are made by a world leader.
Mm-hmm.
How do you not talk about that? I think of John F. Kennedy running for president of the United States as a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was very clear. Very clear. He says, in no way is my Catholicism going to have an impact. And he was very specific about issues.
Right.
There won't be bishops that are appointed to my cabinet. There won't be somebody so fundamentally connected to the church that they're going to be connected to my cabinet. We haven't heard that from Mitt. We need to understand Mormonism a little bit. This issue of White Horse Prophecy is very important, by the way.
I think it is. I really do think it is. We've done entire shows on it. We will again. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman, Mike Papantonio. Check out Pap's show, ringoffireradio.com is the website for it. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And one lucky caller today is going to get a copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. Today's show is underwritten by my favorite investigative reporter, Greg Palast, and his new bestseller, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. Greg Palast investigates Karl Rove, the Koch gang, and their buck buddies. And a fine book it is. A fine book it is. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Bob in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I was just listening to that right-wing guy talk about the National Labor Relations Board elections and the Employee Free Choice Act and their little news clip here about Walmart. I've been a union organizer for 20 years and with many different unions, nurses, teamsters, et cetera. And the reason the Employee Free Choice Act was attempted to pass of card check and majority, card check and some neutrality positions in the act was that there, we actually called the National Labor Relations Board the No Labor Rights Board because there are no punitive damages when companies violate people's civil rights by telling them they can't speak about the union to each other, telling them they can't hand out literature to each other, telling them they can't wear buttons, holding captive audience meetings where they just hammer how bad the union is and you'll lose everything, threatening to fire people, firing people. I mean, I actually had an election at the Fresno Bee newspaper in Fresno some 15 years ago where the police were circling the parking lot and the company told people if you don't leave the premises within 5 minutes after your shift is over, you'll be arrested for trespassing.
Wow.
So if people realize just how bad the lack of civil rights are in the workplace, I think they'd understand why the Employee Free Choice Act was trying to be passed. And can you imagine, Tom, if you and I stood outside a voting booth and did these kind of things when people were going to vote for the national election?
Yeah.
People would freak out that their civil rights are being violated.
So Bob, what has happened to card check?
It's really rough to form
completely off the national radar. I mean, I don't understand why the Democrats aren't running on card check. Let's bring unions back. Let's bring back the middle class.
Yeah, exactly. I'm voting for Obama. I donated to him. I'll walk the streets for him. But to me, I just think that the Democrats need to latch on to these issues like labor rights, civil rights, the voter suppression stuff. I don't know why Obama doesn't stand up for this. Labor rights are what built the middle class. And if you look at every major dictator in the world, from Marcos to the Shah of Iran to Somoza in Nicaragua, the first thing they want to do is crush unions because that's where older white guys like me and a younger black woman or a gay person or whoever have to figure this out and we talk to each other about justice.
Right.
That's why they try to crush them.
That's local democracy. That's democracy in the workplace. That's where people have power.
Right,
Bob,
well said.
Thank you very much. Pap, your thoughts on labor law?
Well, I mean, the labor law issue is no different from any other issue we've faced under Obama the last 4 years. I mean, I'm one of those people that say we have to vote for him. It'll be a disaster if he doesn't win. But I've always been a critic for so many reasons. It's the same. I hear this question. I wonder why. I don't know why Obama. I wonder why Obama does this. I've heard it for years. Mm. And the questions would usually end, I wonder why Obama didn't prosecute anybody on Wall Street for stealing $18 trillion. I wonder why Obama didn't prosecute this particular pharmaceutical company that killed thousands of people with dangerous drugs and then paid a fine after the drug company killed them. I wonder why Obama doesn't take up the call with when the FEC does things that they shouldn't do, when they don't stand in there and support what the FEC is supposed to support. Why won't Obama do things? And, you know, the truth is, yes, we have to elect him, but we need to understand going into the next 4 years, I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of – we're going to hear those same questions. I wonder why Obama won't stand up to this.
Well, at the risk of sounding like I'm blaming the victim, frankly, if we don't start pushing him,
right.
If we don't, and by we, I'm not talking about so much about you and me, but you know, all of us who consider ourselves progressives, everybody listening to the or watching this show, if we don't start showing up at local Democratic Party meetings and saying, I run for precinct committee person, I mean, the Concord Project had this whole thing, you know, all these videos about how to infiltrate the Republican Party for the Tea Party, and they took this thing national, and it was all done under the radar, and they got the, you know, Tea Partiers as precinct committee persons in all these Republican districts, and those are the people who determine who's going to run in the primaries. And so, you know, you got five Tea Partiers running in the Republican primary. Guess who's going to be the Republican candidate? A Tea Partier.
Sure.
And thus 2010 happened the way it did. We've got to do the same thing. If we can take over the Democratic Party, or if we can be enough of a force for the Democratic Party, I mean, I think the Republicans demonstrate the tail can wag the dog.
Well, it can. What ended up happening is we started seeing this shift with Bill Clinton, with NAFTA, CAFTA. We started seeing labor become unimportant. Now we almost, the question, I wonder why Obama didn't go to Wisconsin and show up in Wisconsin and help those people win in Wisconsin. Those questions are becoming too often. I mean, they're too frequent.
Yeah.
I wonder why Obama doesn't take a progressive position because he's not a progressive. I mean, I hate to say that, but that is where it lands. I mean, I am a progressive far, far to the left,
And so Obama looks at somebody like me or somebody who has my politics in their heart, and we're oddballs, you see. We are, but we used to be mainstream Democrats.
But in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt wasn't a progressive either. He ran on a campaign of balancing the budget, slow but steady, continuing Hoover's policies.
Yeah.
He, you know, in the 4 months between the time he was elected and the time he came into office, Frances Perkins came into, you know, he brought her in as labor secretary, and she and Eleanor just started kicking his butt across. You know,
that is true.
And he had an occupation, by the way.
So
you know, from the White House down to the Potomac River, the Bonus Army was occupying Washington D.C.
Do you expect an FDR the second term? I don't.
FDR did not happen in a vacuum. FDR didn't, and it wasn't just Francis Perkins and Eleanor Roosevelt. It was 40,000 people camped on the lawn of the White House all the way down to the Potomac River. It was people all over the United States saying, you know, Mr. President, you've got to help us.
It was virtually every
bank in the nation failing within a week of the time that he was inaugurated.
But, Tom, it began with FDR saying the millionaires and billionaires hate me and I welcome their hate.
Well, it didn't begin with that. That was 6 years later. That was 8 years later.
OK, well, then at that point, maybe that evolution will occur. I hope it does.
Yeah. That was the election of 36.
I'm off on my time. But I respected the fact that he grew to the person who could say that.
That's my point, is that he wouldn't have grown to be that person had the American people not pushed him in that direction. And when he started the CCC, I mean, you know, 10 days into his administration, started a program that put the WPA and the CCC that put a million people back to work. The immediate feedback was so great, but he was able to get it through Congress too. I mean, he didn't have this frigging conspiracy to deal with. Here you got, you know, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Henseling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, Newt Gingrich, and Frank Luntz
meeting the day that.
The night that Obama was sworn into office, meeting just six blocks from here over at the steakhouse at the Caucus Room restaurant in the back end of the building Louise and I used to live in, they had this meeting and basically swore a blood oath to each other that they would do everything to obstruct the president. In fact, one of them talked about, we got to use Taliban techniques. I mean, this is a quote from Pete Sessions. Taliban insurgency. We need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side.
So, Tom, do you compromise with him, and do you say, let me reach across the aisle for these first few years and try to make nice, or do you say, this is a reality I have to deal with, so let me go ahead and side up here? And when you side up, see, that's been the problem here, and I'm really hoping you're right. You say it's dependent on everybody getting involved.
Yes.
I agree with that. Everybody's saying, he's not going to do this.
Not just
alone.
Everybody. Some critical threshold. I think Thorsten Veblen wrote about this back in the 1920s. The Norwegian economist, that there, if you can move 20% of the populace, and particularly if they are the influencers, if they are the class of people, and by class I'm not talking about economic class, but if they're the group of people who tend to be the influencers in society, if you can change them, all of society will change within a year or two. I mean, and he went back and found all these examples of this. And I think that's, you know, that's what happened in the 80s. Reagan created a change. I mean, there was a genuine revolution. There was a change in perspective. You know, he appointed the first labor-hostile Secretary of Labor. And, you know, everybody said, okay, cool. He said, the Department of Education, let's bring in Bill Bennett. He campaigned for president when he was running in the election of 80 on doing away with the Department of Education. We'll put him in charge. Let's, you know, take out PATCO, all these different things. Reagan got people to buy into that. He influenced the influencers, and the influencers changed society. And frankly, I think that we and Obama need to be influencing the influencers. And I disagree with you about him being a progressive. You look back at the things he was talking about when he was a state senator. He understands progressive positions. I think he's been sucked into a power machine, into a power vortex, and he's also discovered that he's got velvet handcuffs on. There's a lot he can't do. But I think that if we push him hard enough, if the people push him hard enough, and frankly, if the economy crashes again after the election and he's president, I think that we might see FDR.
Let's hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's hope. Because right now, my theory about it is, and I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm glad to hear you say that there can be a culmination of events that moves him, a culmination of events and culmination of participation by the American public that moves him. Right now, I'm not seeing it.
Yeah.
I'm hoping you're right.
I think he's got it. You know, and plus, you've got the Progressive Caucus. I mean, you've got 90 members of Congress in there who are taking names and kicking butt. You got people like Bernie Sanders. But everybody wonders, why does Bernie Sanders keep getting reelected? I mean, up in the Northeast Kingdom, I used to live in Vermont. The Northeast Kingdom is solid red. Bernie Sanders carries that 80-90%. Why? Because they know that he's there for the little guy. And that's them. That's progressive politics. We'll be back with more.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Josh wants to disagree with us on CEO coercion. That should be entertaining. Stick around.
Every time I read the news, I'm always more confused.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's unconfuse the news. Today's Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to free Don Siegelman, to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. In the studio with us. It's so nice to see you, Ellen.
Well, thank you very much. The Defense of Marriage Act is, of course, front and center today.
It's toast.
It's almost toast.
Okay.
It has to be heard by the Supreme Court. It has now had two appellate courts strike it down, U.S. Federal Appeals Court in New York, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, 2-1 ruling. So it looks like you've got two of the circuits turning it down. That's very good news.
Yeah.
Not such great news. Catholics United today. They issued a statement on the Knights of Columbus has apparently been spending a lot of money on anti-marriage equality. So what they did is they tracked their spending, $16 million since 2005, on far right-wing social issues.
Wow. Now, hang on just a second. Catholics United is the progressive Catholic.
That's
group, right.
Okay. Exactly. But they're tracking Knights of Columbus spending.
Okay.
And $6.25 million opposing civil same-sex marriage. Of this, more than $600,000 has been in 2012 alone to the great state of Maryland, because you know that's a ballot initiative right now.
Wow.
So, I mean...
You know, it was the Mormons in California, now it's the Catholics. It's like...
Knights of Columbus. Those are the nice guys we grew up with, right?
Yeah,
we thought they were like the best.
Well, you know, it's time to start taxing churches. What can I say?
Well, hey, you're not going to get any disagreement from that. Okay. So, as you know, the Supreme Court could take this up as early as this year. And Standing Hoyer.
What's the this that you're talking about?
2000. In other words, this term, which ends next June or end of May.
What topic might the court take up?
The DOMA.
Oh, okay.
Defense of Marriage Act.
Okay.
Because it's a question of whether they're going to hear it this time or whether they'll probably hear it next time around.
Right.
The other thing is, Standing Hoyer, the House Minority Whip, said he hopes the ruling can convince congressional Republicans to drop their defense of DOMA. And he said they have spent $1.5 million in taxpayer money trying to get lawyers, this is John Boehner, to do this.
So the Republicans are using taxpayer money to fight the administration's attempts to nuke DOMA.
That's right.
Or not to enforce
exactly. And the Congress, many members of Congress.
And they're hiring private attorneys.
They're hiring private attorneys on your tax dollar and my tax dollar.
Sweet, yeah.
Okay.
And John Boehner is running that
thing?
This is
his money.
This is Boehner's thing.
Yes, I have another cousin who worked for him and is now doing advance for Romney. I mean, there's some in every family.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, President Obama was in New Hampshire today. He is also just finished taping The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, so that'll be on tonight.
Oh, that should be.
He said, we don't have to order up some binders to find qualified, talented, driven young women who can learn and excel in these fields right now. He was wearing another pink bracelet for Breast Cancer Month. And he also, the debate in Florida on Monday night is going to be the foreign affairs debate. And he said, we've got a debate on Monday on foreign policy, and I'm interested in seeing what Governor Romney has to say about that. You know, he said that it was tragic the way I ended the war in Iraq. Last week he said we should still have troops in Iraq.
Right. Well, he did.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think most Americans are with Governor Romney on that.
I do not think they are with Governor Romney on this. It's very interesting. The Hispanic vote is certainly something that has been a top of the hit parade. And comedian Paul Rodriguez is a did an ad for Romney today. However, it looks like Project Vote has looked at the statistics. They projected, they said in 2008 that they would get 9.2 million Latinos to vote. They got 9.7 million Latinos to vote, and their projection now is 12.2. And basically they're saying immigration reform is a huge issue for Hispanic people. We all know Governor Romney's not so cool on that issue, to say the least, and the president, of course, has supported the DREAM Act.
Wow.
Okay, so a tax incentive issue.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Carney was asked today by the Washington Post about whether the president is going to veto legislation that does not include a tax increase for couples earning $250,000 a year. He said there's nothing new in this story. The president wants to increase the taxes of the 2% of the wealthiest Americans, and if the Bush tax cuts expire, it'll be gone from 35% to 39.6%. Not exactly a lot of money who is making that kind of money.
Yeah, see, I think they should roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Take it back to 74%. That's when America was prosperous. 50s, 60s, 70s, early 80s, before Reagan dropped it down off 74%.
So there's also going to be a debate tonight, by the way, and it is going to be between Libertarian Gary Johnson, Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who was arrested at the debate at Hofstra University, trying to get in, give me a break. And they're going to have an online debate of their own tonight, hosted by Independent Voter Network. You can submit questions. You can watch. It's very interactive. So that's going on tonight. Now, this is very interesting. At the same time, the folks are complaining about what's going on with DOMA. Turns out the Boy Scouts this is in one area of the country. It is not the Boy Scouts nationally, which is if you listen to some of the other news channels, et cetera, that's what they're saying. But they kept records from 1965 to 1985. They contain names of men who were banned from volunteering with the Boy Scouts because they were accused of abusing young men entrusted to them. However, the Boy Scouts, and again, this is in the northern, Washington state and Oregon, I believe,
the Northwest, yeah.
Did not report any of these people to the cops.
And they were also putting in with that list of suspected pedophiles, they were putting in gay men, which had, who are not pedophiles. They were simply identifying, and they threw them in the same list, which is pretty grim.
I mean, that is grim, but it's also grim that apparently they even had somebody on there, and I heard this from a different source, that had been in prison.
Oh, my. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, free-don.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program. A lot going on in the world. Mitt Romney, it turns out his new chief financial advisor, drum roll, used to be J.P. Morgan Chase's head lobbyist here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, that would make a great financial advisor. Yes, let's give the banks what they want. Let's repeal Dodd-Frank. And I am joined in the studio again by Mike Papantonio, co-host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, the website, and which is heard on the weekends on fine progressive stations all across the nation, plus on the internets and the interwebs and interleaves and all kinds of cool stuff.
Tons of electric stuff.
You guys have an app yet?
Yeah, I think we do.
Yeah, we came out with a Tom Hartman app, and you can see the...
I think we do, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Let me encourage you. It's great fun. Anyhow, let's pick up some calls here. I know that we've got a lot of people who've been on hold for a long time wanting to get in and have their 2 cents. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today? Frank? No Frank. No Frank? Okay. All right. No Frank. Francis in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Francis, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Francis, how are you? I was afraid I wasn't going to get a chance.
Well, here you are.
Been on here. Great, great. I want to thank you for your services, and I also want to say to Mark Pop, and I don't really know how to pronounce his name. I'm sorry, but I watch you on Richard Maddow all the time, and I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Two things I want to bring up here, and I would please ask you if you can get to Rachel Maddow. She brought up a chart.
Yeah, I appreciate your concern, but I don't have it. You know, I know Rachel. In fact, I saw her on a train. You know,
to work with her.
Yeah. We used to be in Air America, and I wish her the very best. God bless her. But calling this show is not a way to get to any other talent on earth other than right here. Tim in Beaverton, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, you know, on these debates, I think they're basically a referendum on voter ignorance and stupidity. It just seems like that to me. When you, the first initial debate, Romney basically lied for an hour and a half, and he won the debate.
I asked the question, how can you win a debate when you've told 27 lies in 38 minutes? I mean, that's not winning.
But obviously, you look at the polls, and there we go.
Yeah.
You know, and ultimately, I think the next couple of weeks, what the Republicans... The optimum thing for them to do to convey what they really feel about things would probably get Orly Tates and George Zimmer involved in their campaign. I think that would be the ultimate.
Yeah, there you go. It is turned into big league wrestling or something. And this is one of the sad things, Pap, about American politics. That in 1987, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing what is called the Fairness Doctrine, but really it should have had a different name, because what it said was that if a radio or television station, and nowadays even cable, because they use public rights of way, a satellite, they use public rights of way. I mean, I think this should universally apply, but none of it does anymore anyway, so it's academic. But if they want to have their license renewed every year, they have to demonstrate that they have programmed, at least in part, in the public interest. And people used to think that that meant public service announcements. But I did news in Lansing, Michigan. It started in radio in 1968. I did news from 71 to 78 in WITL in Lansing. And we had five people in the news department for this little radio station. It was the number one station in Lansing, but Lansing's a little town, and country western station. And the station lost money on that news operation. They proudly lost money on that news operation. And we all knew in the news department, and this was all before Reagan stopped enforcing it, this was the 70s, we all knew that if we were caught talking to the salespeople, we'd get fired. It's like there was this firewall between the two. And because programming in the public interest meant actually having news. I used to, get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Louise and I would go down to the city hall. We'd get the police blotter. We'd go across the street to the state capitol. We'd do the interviews. We'd come back, cut that stuff up. We were doing news, real good old-fashioned, dig-it-up news. Didn't matter if it hurt an advertiser. We if it was true, we reported on it. Reagan said, that's no longer necessary. You can just make money. And then, Clinton with the Telecommunications Act in 96, which was a Republican initiative, really put the nail into that. But it really, I remember in 88 when I believe it was 88, when CBS News was the first, it might have been 87, was the first network to say that they were putting their news division under their entertainment vice president. And all three of the networks used to lose money on news. That was the price of a station carrying your network. And I'm not an advocate of losing money. My point is that they had bureaus all over the world. They actually reported on news. Local stations did.
It was a trade-off.
Yeah.
You have public airways. The public owns this is a commons.
Yeah.
It's no different than any other commons. The public owns this, and we're going to give you the right to use these airways. And the contract with you is that you're going to give us news.
Right.
And then somewhere along the line, people start ignoring it. Now we think NBC or CBS or ABC owns the airways.
Yeah.
They don't. We own the airways. And we've just allowed them to bastardize the process to where news is not even recognizable. The new formula for news on television, if you just tune basically into any channel, it is the interesting looking wonk, the policy wonk, with the big glasses and the big hair next to you call it Beauty and the Beast, I think is the term you use. That's the combination. It doesn't matter that they don't know a lot. It doesn't matter that they're not giving you the news. It doesn't matter that they're not able to talk about a corporation that might be killing us
might be stealing from us. They're not allowed to do that because the guys on the 50th floor say, if you do that, you're going to lose your job.
And this is my problem with NPR now, too.
Of course. I
remember back in the, I believe it was the 80s, when NPR was fully funded by the U.S. government. They didn't have to worry about advertisers. They broke the story of, was it Cargill or, no, it was ADM, Archer Daniel Midland, price fixing. And there was a $300 million penalty, which was big money back in those days. Mm. ADM got hit with a $300 million fine for price fixing on commodities, and NPR had broke that story. They'd done that investigative journalism. And now they're sponsored by ADM. So they dialed back the Republicans in Congress said, okay, let's dial back some of their support. They're no longer, so now they got to go out to advertisers. You're not hearing investigative journalism anymore. In the morning, sometimes I'll listen to NPR, and here's a guy from the Heritage Foundation offering what's supposed to be unbiased. Somebody from Competitive Enterprise was on the other day.
Oh, yeah, without any, by the way, you might want to know, Heritage Foundation does this, this, and this,
right,
and they're a Republican right-wing hack organization. No mention of that.
Well, and not just that, corporate.
Yes, corporate-sponsored
hacks. And so basically what we've got now is we've got this kind of semblance of middle-of-the-road news in NPR and PBS, but it's not really. And it's been badly contaminated. They've done, Lee Atwater did play the refs there. And then you've got basically three other things. You've got sort of progressive news, kind of MSNBC and, our show and stuff like that, where we say, okay, here's our attitude, we're progressives. You got the sort of conservative news, Fox News, basically, and the right-wing talk shows. And then you've got fluff news. What's going to get the most eyeballs? ABC, NBC, CBS. Be sure you've got a story about puppies tonight. Is somebody bleeding? Yeah, that'll lead. The old cliche. Seriously,
bleed leads.
Yeah,
I've got some hope, and I've got some positive things to say. Maybe when we can come back.
Sure,
I'm very hopeful.
Really,
I'm very hopeful.
Wow, I'm hopeful about Obama. You're hopeful about the news.
Yeah,
I mean, we can get each other pumped up here, Pat.
I'm not hopeful about national traditional news. I'm hopeful about what you do, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful about what you do. And I'm going to tell you why it is the way of the future when we come back.
Well, we are one of the things that we're noticing, and this isn't about my show, it's about progressive media in general, is that we're doing well on the stations that we're on, and in those areas where there is no station, in the Missoula, Montana, well, not Missoula, I think we're on in Missoula, but in the little towns that Casper, Wyoming, where there is no progressive station, you got people now picking up the podcast, you've got people picking up the internet, stream, things like that. Hey, we'll talk about that when we come back. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Mike Papantonio in the studio with me here today. We're having fun. He's with Ring of Fire Radio. RingofFireRadio.com is the website. And, of course, the law partner with Bobby Kennedy Jr. and radio partner with Bobby.
Yeah, right? Radio. Yeah.
Good man. Be sure to tell him I said hello.
I will.
Okay, we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more. Your thoughts, my thoughts, Mike Papantonio's thoughts, and the news of the day right after this.
Blinders from the right, brought up by a douche, another blunder for the night. Blinders from the right.
Blinders from the right. Have you seen this, Pap, over on Amazon.com? There's a three-ring binder site. And, we were three-ring binders for sale. And it's got like 5,000 responses to it right now. And they're like, women saying, finally, I found a binder where I can be safe. And men saying, yes, when I look for a woman, I look for this binder. And it's like all these five.
I saw a wonderful cartoon. It was the discussion about the binders. And it had Bill Clinton sitting back looking at the debate and saying, wait, I want to hear more about these women in binders.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's so ridiculous that there's no way to have an intelligent discussion. When a man makes a statement, he's running for president of the United States, and he now has women reduced to binders that, by the way, are a lie. It's a lie, the whole thing.
The binders were actually put together by a coalition of women's groups before the election.
Yes, so, that's right.
And it was for the candidates.
Yeah, not by Mitt Romney.
Yeah, it wasn't like he said, hey, we need more women. Let's go find some binders. There's those binders in the back room. We threw them back there. Anyhow, Charlie in Idaho Springs, Colorado. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind today?
All right.
Tom, it's very good to talk to you. I've been wanting to call a long time, and this is basically just about Medicare saving money. And it was an article by Paul Krugman that from 69 to 2009, Medicare increased 400%. But on the other hand, if we had private health insurance, their premiums rose 700%.
Right.
And
hey, somebody's got to pay for Stephen J. Hemsley's fourth, fifth, sixth house.
Very much.
Pardon? Sorry.
The Republicans are not going to help us out very much. They want to privatize it so their friends can all get rich. Is that the?
Yeah, that's the bottom line. Thank you, Charlie, for the call. It is internalize profits, externalize expenses. It's if you can grab the commons, you know, the whole concept of this country, the thing that the founders fought and died for, was in creating a government of, by, and for the people. To paraphrase Lincoln, who was not one of the founders, but still, is the idea that there are certain things that we do for each other collectively. There are certain things that only can and should be owned collectively. Nobody should be able to lock up the water and say, "I'm the only source of water. If you want it, you got to come to me." Nobody should be able to lock up the legal system and say, "If you want to have justice, you got to come to me." Nobody should be able to lock up the educational system and say, "If you want an education, you got to come to me." Frankly, you go back to FDR, you know, in 1940, you know, his Four Freedoms speech, and he was saying, you know, we should, and beyond that, his Second Bill of Rights, actually the more important one, where he said, you know, we should define food as a right, housing as a right. I mean, education. These are, and yet the whole Republican mantra is screw the commons. You know, there's money to be made, even if it is a natural monopoly, your chance to riff on that.
Well, I think to me, the way I look at this is I'm a fan of Clarence Darrow. I wrote a book one time called Clarence Darrow, The Journeyman. And one of the most important things I ever read that he had to say was that the difficult thing for us to consider is that we're all in it together.
Yeah.
See, he said, "I've come through my entire career, and if I were to go back and look at the horrible things that have been done man to man, person to person in our society, it's when we have forgotten that we're all in this together." The Republican mantra is not "we're all in this together." The Republican mantra is "let me get as much as I can as quickly as I can."
What was the slogan of the RNC? I built it.
Yeah. And of course, Chris Hedges says, a wonderful book that he just wrote. Chris Hedges says when the system starts to crumble, it's those people that don't believe that we're all in together that go grabbing up everything they can, extracting the last parts of the best parts of society and keeping it to themselves. And Darrow said there's under no circumstances can we live together like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question then becomes, if you look at democratic societies that lost their democracy, and there were several in Europe that happened to in the 20th century. It's happened to a number of countries. The question is, do we catch ourselves? Do we go down the road of Pinochet?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, which
it's counterintuitive. You see,
because those are basically the two choices. I mean,
right.
You know, Germany and the United States faced the exact same economic crisis in 1932. Mm. Germany had Adolf Hitler running them, and we had Franklin Roosevelt.
Yes. What's the difference?
Yeah.
Exactly. Look at the difference. But you see, the notion of taking care in thinking of our neighbors and our somebody we don't know, that we have something in common with them, and that by doing better by them we help ourselves, is so counterintuitive. And
why?
It's almost like Gordon Gekko. We first heard him say, "Greed is good." You remember the first time, and we said, "How ridiculous!" I mean, what an awful statement.
Right.
Now we don't think twice when we hear a Republican.
Oh, so what you're saying is that our culture since Reagan has changed to the point where it's counterintuitive.
Exactly.
Because I think that it's the human condition.
Oh no, it is. You know? It is counterintuitive now, but there was a time when
most of human history.
I think. Most of human history, take care of each other, and we all do better.
Right.
Now it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, yeah, it's totally bizarre and something that we need to do. Something about Jeanette watching Free Speech TV in Williamsburg, Iowa. Hey, Jeanette, we have just a minute to the break. A quick comment?
I was curious about your thoughts about fascism and oligarchy. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Sinclair Lewis, in one of his writings, made the remark that fascism will come to America wrapped in a flag with a Bible under its arm, and if this doesn't describe the fundamentalists, well, what does?
Yeah, it was in his book, It Can't Happen Here, in 1909 or 1919. And yeah, absolutely. No, I'm with you, Jeanette. Thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing it out. Fascism is the merger of corporate and state interests, and we are moving down that road, and it scares me.
In every way.
Yeah. Okay, we can talk about that more after the break. It's 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Mike Papantonio in the studio hanging out with us. We're just having a good time today and with you and taking your calls and talking about the news of the day. And shortly, I predict, Shano is going to say, somebody's going to get that book.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What book is that, you say? Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, by me. I'll sign it for you. The bad and the very, very hiatusly ugly, the good. Bernard Whitman, on Fox So-Called News yesterday, talking head Megyn Kelly hosted a focus group to talk about Candy Crowley's handling of the Libya questioning at the debate and to blame Crowley for Romney's shortcomings at the debate. Well, most of the members of the focus group went on to bash Crowley. One member, Democratic pollster Bernard Whitman, didn't. Listen.
Can I talk about a larger point, which is it's sort of amazing that in the face of a relatively poor performance by Romney, all we're talking about is the moderator, Candy Crowley. That sort of underscores.
Don't start with me. This is a 2-hour program. This is what this panel's focused on. We got a lot of other things in the show.
How dare somebody call out the hidden agenda of Fox So-Called News? How dare somebody call out the misinformation machine that is Fox So-Called News? Kudos to you, Mr. Whitman, for standing up to Ms. Kelly and her so-called focus group. The bad. The Washington Free Beacon, the conservative publication, decided yesterday to personally attack one of Tuesday night's presidential debate questioners. You may remember Catherine Fenton, the 24-year-old pre-kindergarten teacher who asked a question about equal pay for men and women in the workforce. Well, the Free Beacon published an article yesterday smearing Fenton, including her past tweets, in an effort to discredit and shame her. The fact that the Free Beacon chose to publicly attack Ms. Fenton is deplorable, but there's a larger issue here. Despite the fact that we live in the 21st century, pay equity is still a very large problem in America. But conservatives are doing all they can to ignore the issue and are perfectly content continuing to let men earn more than women for the same work. And the very, very ugly Ohio Secretary of State John Husted. Two different federal courts have said that Ohio's Republican efforts to restrict early voting cannot go forward. And yesterday, the Supreme Court even weighed in, rejecting another attempt by Ohio Republicans to go ahead with limiting early voting in their state. That's not enough for Husted, who is still determined to go ahead with limiting early voting. Husted is skirting the various rulings and limiting early voting in Ohio to just 16 hours over the course of 3 days. So why is Husted so intent on limiting early voting in his state? Well, typically those who participate in early voting are more likely to vote Democratic. Husted is now openly defying the orders of three separate judicial bodies, including the Supreme Court, in his drive to silence the voices of thousands of Ohioans and rig the election in the Buckeye State for Mitt Romney, and that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Whew. It doesn't get any uglier. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Well, the White Horse Prophecies.
Yes, sir.
In the Christian Bible, it says in Matthew 24:12, the hearts of many will grow cold. You got Bain Capital walking away with pension funds, union health care plans, walking away with millions of dollars. And then in Matthew 24:11, it says false prophets will arise and deceive many. Romney has 100 million prophecies. The GOP spearheads these prophecies and more, many more.
So you see a religious battle here. Gary, thanks for sharing that. I don't know, Pap, I don't see this in religious terms or epic terms. I see this as just good old-fashioned corporate corruption.
Yeah, I see it as man being ugly to man, which is far more in your face than.
Yeah. There have been a lot of people for a lot of thousands of years who've thought these are the end times, and I think very often it's just a it's Freud called a projection. You know, we all struggle with our own mortality.
Yeah, Dominionists, good example. The Dominionist believes, as you know, Tom, that we can completely extract everything we want from this environment. We can mow down our trees. We can pollute our waters. It's okay because the apocalypse is coming anyway. We weren't meant to live all that long, so let's have Israel go to war with Palestine.
Right.
And so that the Dominionists, though, they take it. It really is not only religion; it's their politics mixed with religion.
Remember when Reagan put James Watt in charge of the?
Of course, he was a Dominionist. As you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, when he was asked why, as Secretary of the Interior, he was selling off federal lands to big corporations for pennies on the dollar.
Right, right.
And he said, and it was being polluted and destroyed. He said, it doesn't matter because Jesus will return soon and make all things new.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Now, you know, I consider myself a Christian, but I'm not over the edge like that.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Look, when we are in that mode, Tom, we're not thinking about today. We're not thinking about taking care of each other. We're thinking about, well, it's all over anyway.
Yeah.
And so why worry? But that is
give what you can.
That is eat what you can, get what you can, get away with what you can. It is the crumbling empire. Let me extract everything I can. That is the Dominionist view of the world. Now, I say Dominionist broadly because that's very Southern Baptist too. I mean, that is very fundamental Southern Baptist. I mean, I'm surrounded by it by where I live. There's a Southern Baptist church almost on every block.
Yeah.
And so this is part of the culture. It's not just the religion is separate. It's not like it's a separate entity. It is part of that culture.
Wow. Amazing. John in Acworth, Georgia. Hey, John, thanks for watching listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's on your mind?
Just wanted to ask the two of you, did you notice on the debate with President Obama and Romney recently when Romney was talking about his tax plan and the deductions, and he basically pulled a number out of the sky because he was making it up as he went. And
right.
I wish that President Obama would have pounced on that saying, see, there's a perfect example of what his plan's all about. He doesn't even know it.
Right. It had been $17,000 the week before. Now it was $25,000. And in fact, you're absolutely right. Thank you, John, for pointing that out. Romney even said, let's take a number. For example, I'll just make this up, $25,000. And, you know, once you've taken that as a deduction, you can't take any more. Really, Mr. Romney? But he doesn't want the deduction that allows him to pay 14.5%, 14%, 13%, 11%,
right.
12%, under 15. He doesn't want that nice capital gains deduction to go away.
Tom, isn't the real question how he can say that and everybody just looks at the television and go, oh, okay, you know, I heard that, don't understand. But what to me, that whole setting, I would have been humiliated.
Yeah.
To be in a room where they're calling me an undecided, indecisive voter at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you not know what these two people are about? How do you sit there and say, I'm so low information, I have such a low understanding of the world that I'm 2 weeks out from the election and I don't know what the hell's going on. I don't know which one of these people I ought to vote for.
Yeah.
They're so dramatically different.
What we saw is that that room was not full of those people.
I understand.
That room was full of people who knew how the system worked,
they
just said, I'm undecided because I want to be in the room.
But I'd be humiliated to be called an undecided voter.
You know, at this point
today.
In the election, you know, 2 weeks out, anybody who's undecided, I call them stupid people.
It would be like being a blue-collar union worker who still believes you have enough money to be a Republican. It'd
right.
be the same kind of humiliation.
Yeah, exactly. It's... And one of my favorite quotes from John Kenneth Galbraith, I got it printed out here so I always get the words right. The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for the superior moral justification for selfishness.
Yes, isn't that? That's
perfect. That was like 1930
that he wrote.
You know, and it's just,
it sounds like a bumper sticker, doesn't it?
It really, I mean, he nailed it. Rick in Ormond Beach, Florida. Hey, Rick, what's up? You have a question, Rick? You're on the line? No, Rick. Heard a click. Okay, Rick has gone. Let's go to Gordon in Redding, California. Hey, Gordon, what's on your mind today?
Hello. Tom, are you there?
I am. Are you there?
Okay. Well, I've been waiting a long time to ask this question, a couple of days, actually. I can understand why Obama has been so silent regarding global warming and severe weather change.
Well, actually, in the first debate, he acknowledged global warming. He said it's not a hoax.
Yeah, just a one-liner, dismissively.
I think the problem is that he's confronting, and Gordon, thank you for raising that topic. This is arguably one of the most important topics of our time, and it's not being discussed in these debates. And the reason why it's not being discussed in these debates is because there's hundreds of billions, trillions, really, trillions of dollars in profits at stake here, and those people will squash you like a bug if you get out of line. And the president is not immune to that. I mean, tragically, that's my opinion. I he has done some good things. He has talked a good line in the past. And I think he may well, certainly Romney's not going to. I mean, you know, it's
at least in his vernacular now. I mean, you know, Obama is using those terms, global climate change.
Yeah.
And he has gone as far as say man-made global climate change in one form or fashion.
Right.
We could have never expected that from any Republican president. We certainly can't expect that from Mitt Romney.
Right.
But the truth is, if you buy into how serious this is, and you buy into the notion that if we're from where we are right now, if we raise our temperature 2 degrees Celsius, that we're in an extinction pattern. That's not me talking. That's NASA and some great scientists who've said this is how serious this is.
Right.
So it is a serious topic we ought to be talking about. Hopefully after election, we're going to hear some discussion.
Right. And this September, by the way, 1.21 degrees warmer than the mean.
Yes.
Warmer than the 100-year mean. We're hitting that 2 degrees really much faster than anybody expected.
I'm going down to Antarctica in about a month to see to see what I'm hearing about.
You know, Ellen went there last year. Louise and I had a trip scheduled to Antarctica, and it was the month we were going to leave, the month that my dad was diagnosed with mesothelioma, and so we ended up going to Michigan and hanging out with him instead. And we never made it back, you know, and then we started the radio show. And
I'll come back and report. I'll get pictures firsthand.
Yeah, okay. Come back and tell us all about it. I mean, it's something that it's still in my bucket list to get down there. I'd like to see it. We don't have enough. We only have 4 seconds. Not enough time to take another call. We will. And I promise you, Shano is going to get off the dime here, and he's going to pick a caller who is going to get a free copy of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People, and How You Can Fight Back. And by the way, one of the ways you can fight back, and one of the best ways you can fight back, is by going to movetoamend.org and joining that organization, starting a local chapter and participating. This is a totally grassroots organization. There's no big money behind this. There's no political party behind this. These are good people. Movetoamend.org. Check it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What they want to amend, of course, is the Constitution to say that money is not speech, it's property, and corporations are not people, they're legal artifices. MoveToAmend.org.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Loves this issue, sticks it in here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Lawrence in Berkeley, California.
Hi.
Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind?
Yeah, how you doing? I just say that I live in California, so I'm going to vote for Jill Stein of the Green Party.
Okay.
And if you live in any state like in California where the decision is already made, you know, Obama's ahead here at least 20 points, they say you waste your vote if you vote for the Green Party, but I see it as the opposite. That's the only way I can make my vote count.
Well, and the flip side of that is be careful how you vote on the down ticket races.
Mm-hmm. That's right. If you're in California or for that matter in New York or Texas or Oklahoma, any of the states where it's totally decided, you can vote green, and that's the only way.
Now, here's the one place, Lawrence, where, you know, and as you know, I'm friendly with that argument. As I said, I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 because I wanted the Green Party to have some mojo, and I knew Vermont was going to go Democratic. But on the other hand, in that election, that 2000 election, Al Gore got 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush did, and which is a fact that most Americans are unaware of, 500,000 more popular votes. And I think that, frankly, if the Republicans, you know, succeed in their voter suppression efforts, particularly in the critical swing states, and they somehow manage to pull a rabbit out of the hat, and like George W. Bush did, I mean, you know, they knocked 80,000 people, African-Americans largely, off the voting rolls down in Florida before the election. So the game was rigged. Still, Bush lost. I mean, when they did the recount a year later, although they buried the story because they didn't want to discredit him after 9/11. But nonetheless, it got him close enough that he could steal that election. But lacking that, I think that if there is a large enough popular vote, that it may cause us to revisit. I was debating this morning, actually, over on China TV. It may cause us to revisit our ideas of the Electoral College, because that's not a good system. Thank you, Lawrence, for the call. Pap, what would you do if you were in?
Well, I think numbers matter. I mean, I think numbers matter for policy, for the way we set policy, for the way that we perceive perceive events.
Yeah.
Votes matter. And if this man feels compelled to vote green, I don't know that that'll ever be as significant as having an impact on policy.
It may. I mean, the Green Party, if they get a loud enough voice, they may start pushing the Democratic Party.
We hope so. We hope so. This round, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, this round, there's so much at stake. I'm you know, the Supreme Court. You got three justices who are over 70, over 75.
Yeah. I'd love to. There are things that I just say, good God, I can't stand that. I've got to vote something that I feel really good about. Sometimes you can't do that. This is maybe one of those.
Well,
times.
I actually feel pretty good about Obama.
Okay. Well, I'm.
Edmund in Hilo, Hawaii. Hey, Edmund, what's up?
Hello, Tom and Mike. I got a question. You know the congressman that blocked everything from Obama? And did he have to take an oath to office to be congressman, you know?
You're talking about like Tom Tancredo, Dr. No, who kept putting holds on bills in the Senate?
Yeah.
Or you're talking about these 14 guys who met at the caucus room steakhouse the night that Obama was sworn into office. Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, these guys, and swore, you know, a blood oath to sabotage him.
Yeah, those guys. Did they have to take an oath to office, you know?
Yeah, they do take an oath of office.
And I guess they didn't uphold it, huh?
No. In my opinion, they didn't uphold it. I think signing an oath to a K Street multimillionaire lobbyist like Grover Norquist is a violation of your oath of office.
Yeah, Pat? I think a lot of people agree with it as a violation of the oath. But it's interesting to talk about. But as far as anybody doing anything about it, it doesn't have much meaning. It is obviously I think it's clearly a breach of their oath.
Yeah, amen. Jeff in Santa Margarita, California. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Mr. Hartman and Mr. Papantonio. I want you guys to expand on these concepts a little bit, but, you know, Ayn Rand's philosophy talks about makers and takers.
Right.
When the majority of humanity are actually sharers and givers. Hmm. For 90% of the history of our species, we lived in communal hunter-gatherer groups.
Yes.
Where giving and sharing was a matter of survival. So I can't see how this right-wing ideology can't fail under the weight of just the nature of the way human beings are. Could you guys expand on that, please?
You're absolutely right, Jeff. And, in fact, Shano says that you're the winner of our book recipient of a copy of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. So I'm going to put you on hold, and Danielle will get your mailing information. But I absolutely agree with him. The question in my mind is, how does it go down? You know, does it all collapse? Are we the end of the Roman Empire, or does it reboot? Is this 1932 in America?
Your theory is we reboot. I think
that's my hope.
Howard Zinn, Chalmers Johnson, Studs Terkel, some of these great writers. I mean, you know, they say no, things do get to a critical mass where the structure of empire crumbles to the point where it's not really salvageable.
That happened to Great Britain after World War I.
Of course. Well, it took
They're still here.
They're still here, but it took 75 to 100 years to reboot, I guess, as you put it.
Yeah.
So it's an ugly process. And when you do get to that point of what Howard Zinn, hell, he called it critical mass before he died, what, 4 years ago?
Yeah.
And so it's... We are there. I mean, I don't think there's any question. That's not conspiracy tinfoil and crazy talk.
I think we're there because the fundamentals have not been addressed. The core fundamentals. This is the stuff in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. It's got, you know, 11 steps. I used Hamilton's 11-point plan in 1793 for manufacturers as the model for it. And, you know, we have not changed our trade policy to a rational trade policy. We don't have rational labor policies in the United States. We don't have rational taxation policies in the United States. Our environmental policies, you know, are falling apart. I mean, basically, our social contract has become frayed. And if we don't change those fundamentals, we're in big trouble. And frankly, I don't see it happening soon. I think it's going to take a 32-type crash. to happen. And frankly, I think coming out of that will be something good. I'm the optimist in this thing, so hopefully Howard Zinn's wrong. Hey, I'm Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us. Coming up tomorrow on Tom Hartman Program, get your questions ready. It's Friday, and that means a full hour of Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be taking your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.